Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Mind the Meds, the neurology pharmacy-focused podcast from Pharmacy Times. I'm your host, Erica Marini. This episode is coming out early September 2026. And, you know, after a busy summer and, coming to you guys and reporting our big things every month, I really don't have very much to report this time. We did start soccer last week with my almost four-year-old, which was, let's just say, a mixed bag of big emotions coming from my son. My little 19-month-old Peanut, my daughter, she's actually starting a little soccer program that they do at, they come into the daycare. But she is, when I say Peanut, I mean, she's just shy of getting on that growth chart. So let's all cross our fingers she's not trampled immediately. I feel like this is really a month of looking ahead for us, though. We're thinking about fall projects, my son's birthday next month, hopefully a visit from family. But I hope that for anyone with kids that the back to school transition has gone smoothly, and hopefully the weather wherever you are is starting to be a little less hot if you've had a hot summer like we have, and a little more favorable for evening walks or sitting outside with your favorite beverage or whatever you like to do in the fall. But let's get into our neurology news for August. So a couple updates on pipeline agents. The FDA has cleared the way for a phase 2 trial of Lucid MS in progressive multiple sclerosis. This is a novel chemical entity that targets protein arginine deaminase 2, or PAD2, which is an enzyme implicated in myelin degradation. So there's a lot of potential here if it can really get at the underlying cause of disease progression with that myelin degradation. So we'll have to watch for updates as they get through their phase 2 trial. The FDA has also granted fast-track status to ACI-7104, which is an anti-alpha-synuclein active immunotherapy, being called an early Parkinson's vaccine in the news reports that I saw. This entity is designed to induce production of alpha-synuclein-specific antibodies, preferentially recognizing aggregated alpha-synuclein species that are toxic to neurons. So its role would be during prodromal and early stage PD or Parkinson's disease, and their phase 2 vaccine, spelled V-A-C-S-Y-N, trial is currently ongoing. Next, we had a health alert from the CDC regarding B-cell therapies. This alert brought focus to the increased risk of severe arboviral neuroinvasive disease when patients are on B-cell depleting therapies. These are therapies we see a lot in multiple sclerosis and lesser in, or a lot in neuromyelitis optica, sometimes in myasthenia and other kind of random autoimmune conditions. So when I say arboviral diseases, I'm talking mostly about tick and mosquito-borne disease. Those are obviously the most common. So you might be saying, oh, why now? This season is kind of ending. But there are still many weeks in the active arbovirus season, and people are also always traveling to areas where it might be an issue. So obviously, different ways to address this. I just want to bring attention to it. I personally added to my standard counseling points, you know, this medication increases your risk for infection, including from tick and mosquito-borne disease. So just drawing, putting that language in there to foster a discussion and bring attention to that. So now let's go through a few interesting articles that might be worth the read that I saw from the past month. First, there was kind of, a controversial one out of JAMA Neurology in August that took a look at safety of anti-seizure medications during direct oral anticoagulant therapy in epilepsy. So while strong enzyme-inducing anti-seizure medications were unsurprisingly associated with higher thromboembolic risk, I think we all knew that, but this cohort study also showed higher thromboembolic risk with levetiracetam, which is generally considered a safer option with low interaction potential. So, you know, this did raise the level of concern there. I did read an article on the article where they interviewed experts that did express some skepticism, some concern about confounders. And so they did caution that we shouldn't be running out and trying to change patients' treatment plans based on this article, but it's maybe something worth keeping in mind and investigating further when we can. The Lancet Neurology had a systematic review and individual patient meta-analysis taking a look at intensive blood pressure lowering after a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage with regard to secondary stroke prevention. It was called RECAP-ICH. I think there are still unanswered questions about using intensive blood pressure lowering. So this review provided, I think, more positive data for the intensive approach. It showed reduction of recurrent stroke via prevention of recurrent hemorrhage and did not show an excess or an increase in serious adverse events. So I thought those were my takeaways, but I would definitely invite my critical care colleagues to take a closer look at that one. And lastly, I want to talk briefly about the hot-off-the-press new guideline that was just published. Pharmacologic treatment for migraine prevention in adults, which is a report of the AAN, or American Academy of Neurology Guidelines Committee, and the American Headache Society together. This was just published on August 31st in the Neurology Journal. We could certainly do a whole episode on this, and my wheels are kind of turning, so maybe we will. But for now, just know that these guidelines are a significant update since the last ones came out in 2012, and they incorporate all of the data on our new agents like CGRPs. A lot has certainly changed in how we treat migraine in that time, and so these guidelines are definitely worth the read and worth a real read, real look through. Big themes so far that I have seen are the recommendation to offer preventive treatment to all patients experiencing four or more migraines a month. And I think that this is due to the inclusion criteria in a lot of trials now. Also, another big theme is including patients in the treatment decision-making process. And then what I really liked and what I'm really looking forward to seeing and applying to my practice is they took a look at a lot of different scenarios. And this isn't even all of them, but things like pregnancy, different comorbidities, patients with different priorities like cost or efficacy, medication overuse headache, which I think is the first time it's being addressed in the guidelines, as well as many others. So it looks, I think it's a very readable guideline, and I think it's a very usable guideline as well. So I'm really looking forward to looking at this more in depth and again, applying it to practice and discussing it with colleagues. But now, we've reached the end of our time for news updates. That's everything I have. So let's get into our special topic for today. Today, we're talking all about vaccines as kind of a Vaccine Awareness Month wrap-up. Now, vaccines obviously hit every space, and I'm excited to talk to our guest today, Dr. Patty Yeager-Stone, about vaccines in neurology specifically. Patty, welcome to the podcast. Can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me. I'm a fan, so I'm happy to be here. My name is, like you said, Patty Yeager-Stone. I'm a clinical pharmacist in neurology at the VA Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. I did want to be clear and just mention that everything that I say today is my own opinion and I'm not representing the VA.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to be going through a few topics about your practice and about vaccines today. So how would you say, where and how do vaccines fit in your practice?
Yeah, so when I stepped into this role back in 2018, sort of one of the first things I was asked to help improve was the infusion management. So patients with neurology on infusion medications. We have a lot of trainees here, residents and fellows. So I actually now oversee ordering and monitoring labs and infusions for about 120 patients from neurology. So most of the discussions that I have about vaccines are sort of in that context. Also, whenever there's a patient that needs a new treatment where vaccines are a consideration, which is very common for neurology. I'm sometimes involved with the patient directly in the hospital room because I work on the inpatient side as well as in the clinic, or sometimes I'll get pulled into the clinic room or make a phone call to talk to the patient about details, which vaccines we recommend for them. And then I'm also involved with coordinating the vaccine administration and minimizing the treatment delay. So, you know, there's frequent scenarios where we want patients to be vaccinated before we start a certain medication. So I sort of am the one that stays on top of that to minimize the time delay while making sure they get the vaccines that they need. So it's mostly infusions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting to talk to someone
from the VA where everything is kind of in-house and you can sometimes see more things than, you know, I might see as someone who, you know, gets, you know, I see the patient in clinic, but then they get their vaccines at the pharmacy down the street and our records aren't. So I'm, you know, so I'm a little bit jealous of that VA and how connected everything is.
It is nice. Frequently I'll communicate directly with the primary care nurse, for example, to make sure that, everything gets buttoned up.
Oh, absolutely. Well, sounds like you're a perfect person for this topic. You recently even gave a talk on vaccine considerations in specifically neuroimmunological conditions. And that especially is such an important topic. Like you mentioned, we have a lot of stronger immunotherapies, sometimes infusions, sometimes not, being used in spaces like multiple sclerosis, myasthenia, CIDP. To get all of our listeners on the same page with kind of what you're facing on a day-to-day, what are some things to consider with vaccines and immunotherapies?
Yeah, so I guess just first of all, the bird's eye view, a lot of the medications that we're offering that are immunomodulating or immunosuppressant put patients at increased risk of infections, or maybe they're less able to fight infections that they could catch. So that's one side of it. But then also some of these medications also impair the immune response the patient's able to mount in response to a vaccine. So that's the kind of overall reason why we need to be thinking about vaccines and offering them before we start a lot of these treatments.
Yeah.
Timing of that's important. As I briefly mentioned before, a lot of these medications, we should avoid live vaccines. That's many, many classes of medications that we use to treat our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to consider. I think that's a wonderful summary and a lot of what we have to go through and think about kind of through the lens of what I think kind of only a pharmacist can look through of all of the essential steps. You need the pre-treatment labs, you need the pre-treatment vaccines, you need all the education. And it's, I think, an increasingly important part of the puzzle. So thanks for that succinct summary.
Yeah, I agree. And there's an article I wanted to mention that was super helpful for me that I refer to now in practice. It came out in Continuum in April. I'm a big fan of Continuum anyway, but in April they had their multiple sclerosis issue. And there was an article specifically regarding infection risk and vaccine considerations. And there's tables in there that go through each vaccine. And there's a different table for each medication with vaccine and infection considerations. So that's a really useful resource.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great plug. I'm going to take a look at that as well. Now I have a more specific question just because I've gotten it a number of times before. And so I think it might be timely for a lot of people, but choosing between pneumococcal vaccines, that space is very busy. There's a lot of pneumococcal vaccines past and present. And so what to do when patients have received old pneumococcal vaccines and when do they need more, and also how to choose between the newer agents is a more recent question. So the Prevnar 20 versus the Capvaxiv 21. What is the guidance there? What are you kind of counseling people or educating people about, and what resources are available with that?
Yeah. Previously, I would bother my infectious disease colleague frequently because it is just so confusing with all the different vaccines and clinical scenarios that do come up. But my favorite tool regarding pneumococcal vaccine is the CDC has it's an app and also a website called PneumoRex Vax Advisor. I think it's fairly new, maybe a year and a half, 2 years old at this point. And you can actually just click through and fill in your patient, like, demographic things like their age and their risk conditions. And specifically, a listed risk condition is acquired immunodeficiency, which is so many patients on a lot of these medications. That's a tool that I use every time I'm reviewing pneumococcal vaccines. I double check what I believe to be the case to make sure it lines up with what I was thinking of doing. And then as far as the PCV 20 and 21, here in Oregon, our health department actually tracks the invasive pneumococcal cases that come up here. Some states do, some states don't. But in Oregon, specifically serotype 4 is responsible for more than 30% of the cases of invasive pneumococcal disease. And the PCV21 vaccine, even though it was formulated specifically to include serotypes that predominantly affect adults, the PCV21 vaccine does not include serotype 4. So here, my infectious disease colleagues have made the decision that we carry the PCV20 formulation and not the 21. Other states that I found from the CDC that also have the same high prevalence of serotype 4 include Alaska, Colorado, Navajo Nation, and New Mexico. So maybe if you're treating patients in one of the Western states, should think about serotype 4 and whether you need to protect your patient specifically from that one. So yeah, Pneumorex Vax Advisor.
Yeah, also another awesome resource. And we actually share that same. I also recommend Prevnar 20 specifically mm-hmm. in immunocompromised patients.
Yeah.
Because again, of the, yeah, it's important that the 21 doesn't necessarily contain all of the 20 plus one.
Right.
Which I feel like is the education barrier that sometimes you have to get over because, yeah, a lot of people, providers, patients alike, think that we're a lot of these vaccines are just kind of adding on new things.
Right. Well, it looks the same, but it's got one more.
Yeah, exactly. So it's better, right? And so it's really important. And yes, in our immunocompromised patients, we also recommend the 20 based on the serotypes it includes.
That's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah. But we are we are in Utah, so we're pretty close to you. So now I want to go through a few super short case scenarios just to help the listeners see how we might approach. But these are very short, very few words. So that's a disclaimer. I'm going to give you very little info. And obviously, if you had more info, what you say would change your approach completely. But right. So this might not happen very often at the VA, but it might happen sometimes. What if you have a patient, they want to start therapy on a patient, but they have no vaccine records available?
Yeah, it is a scenario that doesn't come up very often where we have zero information, but it is common that we'll have patients moving around the country and we might not have every piece of information that we wish we had, so incomplete. I guess the way I'm thinking about it is as if they've never had any vaccines. I don't know if that's similar to how you approach it. And then in cases where it's appropriate to look at serologies, I would start with that if the patient seems like they don't want to just get all the vaccines. And of course, talking to the patient to see what they remember. Although I know from personal experience that memory is not that reliable. For example, I just got my Tdap updated, even though I thought it hasn't been 10 years already. It's been more like 14 years. So wow. Anyway, yeah, and I'm a vaccine person, so I shouldn't be on top of this. Yeah, so all that to say is we really do need the documentation. We can't really just take people's word for it, unfortunately. So serologies can be helpful in certain situations. And then as far as which vaccines to prioritize, obviously you need more information about the patient's specific scenario to kind of get into that, but including them in the discussion, of course, which vaccines are most important to them in the context that it might be that something's recently changed, whether it will make them be looking at vaccination. So I guess I'm curious what you would do or how you would handle it.
Yeah, it happens. I would say a fair amount here, but we follow kind of the same approach of both getting serologies where appropriate. So we often are getting panels of, hepatitis B. We added measles here pretty routinely. Mm-hmm. As shout out to Utah, just centered on the epidemic. Yay. Mm-hmm. got myself off track. Hep B, measles, VZV, are honestly checked in everyone, even regardless of if mm-hmm. your immunization history is available. But if someone has no vaccine records available, it becomes kind of a bigger deal trying to track those down if possible, and then vaccinating as soon as possible and right. as much as the patient can tolerate. Because we don't want to delay getting therapy started.
Yeah.
I think
And
there's
also, like, the opportunity when people are in, also, like, how much can we get done today, right?
yes, absolutely. When someone is engaged and has a willing arm. Okay, case two. So the patient got started, despite your best efforts, the patient got started on immunotherapy without getting vaccines first.
Yeah. I guess the first thing I would want to do is make sure the patient understands that vaccine. So we've talked previously a little bit about how some of the vaccine response might be blunted, especially with like the anti-CD20 medications. But so we know that some of the medications kind of influence vaccine response, but I would make sure the patient knows that we still find that vaccines are still beneficial for them, even in that scenario. So we learned kind of during the COVID pandemic that there's more of a T cell response than previously understood to vaccines. It's not all about antibodies. So we'd still explain that we recommend vaccines and that they can still benefit from vaccines. That's number one. And then the second thing is just mostly about timing. So again, in that example of the like ocrelizumab type medications that are dosed every 6 months. If you can time the vaccine toward the end of the dosing window, so when their B cells have reconstituted a bit, but also not delaying the medication treatment, we find that we get a like more bang for the buck of the vaccine. We get more benefit from it if we're careful about the timing when appropriate. Of course, that doesn't include things that are seasonal, like flu vaccines, but a lot of times it is a strategy that we do use.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. We would approach it the same way. The same way here, with just the added, and I'm sure you guys do this too, but like once you're on something like ocrelizumab for MS or something like that, you can no longer get a live vaccine. So
Right.
if the plan was to maybe you didn't show measles immunity, then unfortunately we've lost that window to get that until after.
Yeah.
Until, yeah, potentially you're not on immunotherapy anymore.
Right.
But yeah, otherwise, 100% agree. The third thing is how do you approach vaccine hesitancy, especially in the scenario where, yeah, maybe you want to start someone on medication, and so kind of timing is important.
Yeah, so I guess my approach is same as everyone's, I'm sure, is just re remembering that empathy goes a long ways and being non-judgmental, including patients in their care, especially in this context. I feel like people really appreciate that. I try to understand what they're specifically concerned about rather than just hitting points and making them more anxious to getting them worried about things they hadn't been worried about. So I kind of try to discuss and understand what it is that they're specifically concerned about and try to address that specifically. And then also, in these scenarios where we're starting or wanting to start medications, I sort of explain as friendly as I can, explain the rationale for the specific vaccine that we're recommending and why, in the context of the medication that they're thinking about starting, that would be important for them. Yeah, and again, serologies, as you've mentioned, can be reassuring to some people too. Like, hey, we don't need to do these ones probably, but let's check, you know. But yeah, I just think there's just a lot of chatter out there now, and people are having a hard time knowing what to believe. So just remembering that, like, there's a lot of confusing information hitting people and just meeting people where they are, I find to be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I read somewhere to be like, yes, to talk about something specific, but be succinct. Like, don't try to throw a package insert at someone. Like,
No.
not going to be helpful. And yeah, I worked at the VA as an intern. This was like 12 years ago now, and that patient population specifically can be, I would say, firm in their beliefs,
Yeah, that's probably
which I
true.
would say, that was at the Boston VA. So a population, a culture that is firm in their beliefs. Embedded in another VA culture that is in firm their beliefs. So
Yeah.
yeah, got some experience there, and I don't know if the Oregonian VA patients also give you a run for your money there.
We have a pretty diverse population here. Yeah. I love the vets.
Yeah. You're the sweetest. Okay. Awesome. Thanks for going through those with me. I think that's really helpful for anyone maybe just starting practice, especially. So now on to some hot vaccine topics. Recently, I feel like I should have a jingle there or something. So first, the guidance on, we've talked about live vaccines already, just as a maybe a little teaser, but so the guidance on live vaccines in MS is actually shifting a little bit. So historically, the recommendation was pretty clear. We didn't recommend live vaccines at all once you have a diagnosis of MS because of concerns for post-vaccination relapses. But there was a cohort study from June, so pretty recently in this summer, that contributed to some easing of that concern, which was especially important in our population because it had to do with the MMR vaccine. Can you tell us about that? And have you guys changed your practice at all based on this?
So our practice is sort of invalidating for us because we have been offering live vaccines within people with MS, even if, I mean, sorry, only if, of course, they're not on those drugs that we shouldn't. But yeah, so it's sort of just been a validating bit of information for us to have. Yeah, especially now with the measles cropping up around here also, we're definitely more on top of offering MMR when people need to be protected and are not. So.
So this article was another good set of data that showed that kind of debunked a little bit that historical data of having live vaccines cause relapses or trigger relapses in the MS population. So, it definitely gives us a lot more ability, or a lot more reassurance, I would say, validation, like you said, that yes, if someone doesn't show immunity to measles, like absolutely get them vaccinated, especially based on what's going on. And I think that, it's changed our practice a bit. Mostly the measles epidemic, I think, has changed our practice more. I feel like for a long time, measles serologies were like, sometimes checked, and maybe,
Lower on the list for sure,
yeah,
yeah.
like definitely in the case of someone that, someone didn't have their vaccine history or different scenarios, but it's not in like every patient like it is now that we're thinking about it. So this article definitely came out at a good time and could definitely, I think, help to extrapolate some data, for certain travel vaccines and things like that that are also live that hopefully we'll have more data on for our MS patients too.
Yeah, good point. I also remembered recently when looking into this measles stuff, since it's cropped up again, is that I had forgotten or maybe never learned that people on immunosuppressant immunomodulating medications might have an atypical presentation when, if they were to come down with measles. So, like, some of those patients might not even get a rash, but would be ill. Yeah, so I definitely am concerned about measles and people with MS and other neurologic disorders.
Hopefully they don't walk into their MS clinic with their atypical.
Right.
But we'll see. I'll let you know how it goes if the cases don't get under control here. So next, let's spend a little time discussing the new mRNA flu vaccine. So this was just approved, this month. Emflusiva, the first mRNA flu vaccine. It's approved in patients 50 years and older. Now, mRNA vaccines, of course, came into the spotlight when the COVID vaccines were first approved. We have, I think, two COVID vaccines are mRNA, one is not. But so anyone who doesn't know what the difference is between kind of a historical flu vaccine and this mRNA flu vaccine, so historically, a non-live vaccine would contain either a deactivated virus, a weakened virus, or a protein subunit, so some part of virus, using that to train the immune system to fight off future flu infection. An mRNA vaccine, though, doesn't require any part of the virus. They leverage this mRNA messenger RNA technology to be able to instead just direct cells to produce specific antigens and thereby elicit an immune response. So there are a few benefits proposed for mRNA vaccines over traditional vaccines. Since they're non-infectious, you obviously eliminate any potential risk for infection associated with the vaccine. Their production process is very quick, which is maybe one of the best benefits because they allow for flexibility and being able to quickly manufacture variant or multivalent vaccines. And so obviously that last part sounds kind of ideal for a flu vaccine, right? Because we're trying to match the prevalent strains every year and predict that pretty far in advance right now based on the production cycle. And so the quicker we can adjust that, the better. Now, as far as data, you know, in one study comparing this new mRNA vaccine, Influceva, to the standard dose flu vaccine in patients 50 years and older, influenza-like illness occurred in 2% of Influceva patients versus 2.8% of the comparator standard dose, a relative vaccine efficacy of 26.6%. So that did meet their criteria for superiority for the mRNA vaccine. They did do another trial showing strong immunogenicity rates in an over 65 group compared to high-dose flu vaccine. But this is being followed up with clinical endpoints in a post-marketing trial in that older age group. So potential superiority, however, important to keep in mind, side effects were higher in the mRNA vaccine group, such as fatigue, headache, ALGAs, so like everything you'd expect from a flu vaccine, but sometimes with significant jumps in rates in the mRNA group versus the standard group. So talking like 40% of fatigue in the mRNA group versus only 20% in the standard dose group. So something to keep in mind. There's a little summary around here, I would say. We're all still a little bit in denial that flu season is starting up again. So we haven't talked about it much as a group. Has there been any talk in your space, or what are your thoughts about this this new inclusion in the space?
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot from my facility just yet. We're just now kind of starting to get into the swing of things again for flu season. I am excited by the idea that we could have a faster timeline to produce the flu vaccine with this technology. And I agree that that's the most exciting part for me, is that we might be able to select variants that more closely match what we see in our communities and get better prevention in the years to come with that technology. And also, I guess maybe just because, maybe primarily because I have a teenage son, I hear mRNA vaccine and I think myocarditis. So I definitely looked into that specific to see, and I was happy to hear that there were no signals for myocarditis, and they looked for those in the flu trial with the new mRNA vaccine. So that's nice. What's kind of interesting. I'm interested to hear it kind of play out more with efficacy, to see if those increased like reactions right after the vaccine, it seems to be mostly like that, to see if those increased numbers are worth taking if you get better benefit out of the vaccine. So
yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Thank you for bringing up the myocarditis, because that is such an important thing and something that people bring up a lot with the mRNA vaccines. And I loved the idea of the production times as well, because that is one of the most common things I get as far as vaccine hesitancy with the flu vaccines is like, oh, well, they never get it right anyways. They never get the strains right anyways. And so that would be really cool to get it better. Really was.
It would.
But for right now, it's just another one in the space. It's because of the age selection, it's not, I don't think it's going to be a common one. It's definitely not the one like offered by my employer for our mandated flu vaccine, anything like that. So I think we'll see more to come, and maybe not for a couple years, it getting more of the market share, I would think. But
agree. Probably more studies in different populations.
Yes, that would be appropriate. And we'll see if the efficacy data is better or the same in that higher age group, that over 65, where it's really important. And definitely a lot more to come on mRNA vaccines in general, like in oncology for sure, and beyond. And that will be beyond the scope of this podcast, because I'm not good at oncology.
Me neither.
Our last hot topic, and kind of a public service announcement. It's something that I've been really trying to spread around here because I think it's important, no matter honestly what space you practice on, is really the growing and really very impressive data for prevention of dementia with vaccines. It's really inspiring to me and motivating to have hard conversations about vaccines as the population ages, because no matter what the patient is in clinic for, it's a really impactful intervention that you can make. And in my experience, most of the aging population is really worried about dementia, is really worried about cognitive difficulties. And so it's really exciting. There's a lot of data in this space. And I think it's really important to share as well. I talked really briefly. I did like a one-liner about the newest data for Shingrix in this a couple episodes, but episodes ago, and we'll go into it a little bit more here. But in general, Patty, can you tell us briefly kind of which vaccines so far have the strongest data for reducing risk of dementia?
Yeah, I would agree with you that Shingrix is probably the one with the most and best data. It is an exciting area for sure. Just in the past few years, there have been so many papers published looking into vaccines and possibly lowering the risk of dementia. So a lot to come. I feel like we have a lot of data now, and there's a lot more that will be coming out in the next probably few years. Little reminder and slash disclaimer a little bit. As excited as we are and as much information as we have and want to share, these trials are observational, and we aren't going to have, unfortunately, randomized controlled trials looking into the associations between dementia risk and vaccines. So just keeping in mind that we need to be mindful about how we think and talk about the data just because it is observational. However, there have been several different vaccines, like you said, associated with probably decreasing risk of dementia, the strongest one being shingles vaccine, but also RSV, influenza, and Tdap, I would say, are the top of the list from what I was able to find. We have pretty good evidence that viral and several different types of viral and bacterial infections are associated with increasing the risk of dementia. So it stands to reason that by preventing those infections from happening, we can lower dementia risk. And the up-to-date article actually on prevention of dementia includes shingles vaccine in there. So I think that's interesting and kind of cool, I guess. It sort of strengthens our position. So I thought a couple of things that I thought were interesting when I was looking into this topic. The recombinant RSV vaccine shares an adjuvant with the recombinant shingles vaccine. And there's a theory that maybe the adjuvant itself plays a role in addition to the vaccine effects, which I thought was interesting. I'd like to know more about that, but I thought it was interesting and worth sharing. And also with influenza, their association with a lower risk of dementia was found when you look at people who had never gotten a flu vaccine during the time period they were assessing and people that got one. So getting one flu shot in a certain period of time is protective, but they found a higher association with the more annual flu vaccines a person gets. So it accumulates. It seems to be more flu vaccines is more protective, which is compelling to me. And they also noticed there's a different paper that found the high dose flu vaccine was better than the standard dose in people that were eligible for that as far as lowering dementia risk. So those are the things that I thought were interesting and kind of worth sharing. There seems to be, at least in the shingles data that I saw, pretty major differences between men and women, though. And I'm curious about that. I don't know if anyone has the answer as to why that might be, but I'd like to know more about that. But it seems to be good. It seems that shingles vaccine specifically does reduce the risk in both men and women, but I'm just curious why there would be a difference.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting stuff going on.
Yeah, there is a lot of interesting stuff, and I'm glad that it has so far added up to get vaccinated, because that is obviously my stance.
We want to know if there's something bad going on, but it's like so nice when there's a side effect, if you want to call it that, that's beneficial, in addition to just not getting shingles and other infections, which is already great and worthwhile.
Yes. Yeah, the shingles data is especially impressive. You can visit other, there's like a Global Vaccine Alliance that has like a whole article about different vaccines that have, well, kind of middling data, but again, just kind of like positive, reassuring stuff. It just definitely doesn't, I've not seen any signals for worsening dementia with any of these vaccines.
Right.
So that's a great thing. But yes, the Shingrix, you know, that most recent article I saw that I mentioned a couple episodes ago, I think it was published in Annals of Internal Medicine, and I'll talk about it just briefly. Also because there was a pharmacist as the lead author, and I just love
Love that.
supporting and yes, elevating the work of pharmacists. So this was Dr. Kayleen Hayes out of Brown School of Public Health and her colleagues. They took a look at Medicare beneficiaries 66 years and older, specifically admitted to skilled nursing facilities over a 5-year period that had no diagnosed dementia and were eligible for Shingrix vaccine. So that within that cohort, that included almost 510,000 patients across more than 5,000 facilities. So quite the bear of data analysis for that team. Whoa. So the unadjusted cumulative risk for dementia over 4 years was 18.3% in the Shingrix group. So that's having just received one dose, even though the, you know, the full cycle is two, but this, they included it if they just got one dose, and 24.8% in the not dosed group. So showing a 24% relative risk reduction for dementia in that group. So like you already mentioned, observational study, there were definitely some confounders, and the manufacturer of Shingrix was a sponsor, although had no role in, you know, the nuts and bolts of the trial. But overall, like I said, a compelling article. And yeah, if the pain of shingles can't get you to get the vaccine, I hope potential prevention of dementia can, because I have personally seen in my own family how
Yeah.
kind of messed up cognitively you can get when you're in that much pain chronically for months. So absolutely a really great study from Dr. Hayes and a fellow pharmacist. So
I appreciated how they designed it to try to get around, like to account for confounders, which was pretty creative, I thought, and
yeah, I think
interesting.
that they did, and I think they even did kind of different analyses to show, even if you took these things into account, like you still at the very least would, I think they said maybe a 12% risk reduction. So, which is, you know, still I think a
Like that,
compelling
yeah.
data point. So, it's definitely, you know, although we mostly in our clinic have patients who are ambulatory and walking, and this was in a skilled nursing facility, it's definitely data that I'm going to use, I think, to try and increase those vaccination rates. How do you guys do at Shingrix there at the VA? Is the primary care pretty on top of it?
Yeah, I think there's a clinical reminder that lets them know the visit time of the visit that they should offer it. But I do find in my practice, I'm wondering if it's the same for you, that people are more hesitant to get Shingrix than some other vaccines. I think there's some reasons for that. It does have a reputation for causing arm pain. I've definitely heard patients talk to each other about that. And also just that shingles isn't contagious, and the mortality is different than like some of the other vaccines we're offering to protect against like flu, which, COVID, all these things that we know can be like can cause mortality. And like, anyway, so I think those are reasons that people tend to be more hesitant to get the shingles vaccine. But I do think that this is good information to include in conversations. Yeah, dementias. Pretty much everyone I think knows of someone that has dementia or had dementia, and it's devastating. So anything we can do, we should probably think about doing to lower the risk, especially if it's going to get you out of a terrible, painful shingles episode as well.
Yeah, seems rational to me, and I hope it I hope it changes some minds. But yeah, Patty, anything else to add? I think we've done Vaccine Awareness Month justice here in the neurospace today. Any last comments about vaccines?
Actually, yeah, there was something I was thinking about mentioning and couldn't figure out where it would belong, about complement inhibitors. We only have a few people on complement inhibitors, but I think it's worth mentioning a few things about that, just because there are really strong recommendations. So this would be like, we use mostly ravulizumab here, but also eculizumab, and there's some other newer ones. And then just the idea that people so I guess C5 complement inhibitors, we know, increase the risk of meningitis specifically like 1,000 to 2,000 times. So I'm sure that a lot of pharmacists, when they hear the word complement inhibitor, think immediately meningococcal vaccine. So definitely, I just wanted to remind that there are different ACIP recommendations for people starting those therapies than for the general population, and to make sure and take a close look, and offering vaccines particularly for those people. And then also there was a paper last year where, so it's always been a guideline to get vaccinated when possible before starting therapy with those medications, but also it's been an option to also give antibiotics throughout the entire treatment, which I don't think many people in my area do offer that. But anyway, there was a paper last year that talked about the idea that people can still get meningococcal infections despite vaccination. So they compared people who were double covered with antibiotics and vaccines, as well as boosters, versus one or the other. And they found a significant difference in the number of cases. So just kind of mentioning that we should probably think more seriously about offering antimicrobials along with vaccines and making sure patients are boosted.
Oh, that's a little bit scary. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I
might. Okay, yeah, it's a low enough case number that it's not something that you would probably notice, like from just like your own practice. So that's why it's important to follow up with studies like we have in the literature. So
yeah.
Anyway, that was
a very important call out, and I think another thing about them is that we. Meningococcal vaccines is like so important, but it also increases your risk of other kind of encapsulated bacteria.
Right. Yep.
As well. Awesome. So we focus a lot on meningitis, but like Haemophilus B, I think, is encapsulated.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other things. So, kind of infection prevention, in general, in that population. Don't just worry about a stiff neck, guys. We got some other things to keep in mind here. So yes, a very important call out. Thank you so much, Patty. Thank you. So many insights. This has been such a great discussion. I have to end though, like I end every episode, with a little work-life balance, which in my favorite way, some travel inspo. Now, I would love to talk to you about the Oregon coast because I would love to be there. But what is somewhere that you have visited that was awesome and that you would recommend to others?
I haven't gotten to travel as much in recent years as I wish I could, I love Eastern Europe. I studied in Prague for a semester as an undergrad and went back to Slovenia for a month as a pharmacy student on a rotation in a community pharmacy.
Cool.
It was so cool. So Slovenia in particular is a wonderful little country with mountains and ocean and beautiful red roofs. But I love Eastern Europe.
And where, what is kind of the main city in Slovenia? Was the rotation set up in kind of rural area or a city?
Yeah, Ljubljana is the capital, and that's where the pharmacy student set me up with an apartment, which was amazing. I took a bus and then a train, and then I walked half an hour to the pharmacy, though. It was in a little town outside Ljubljana. But even that was like an experience, right?
Yeah. Walking in Slovenian streets. It's amazing.
It was great. And the pharmacy students there, it was amazing. They showed me around, got to drink some warm, new novel beers. They took me to a festival. It was fun. It was so fun. But I just had a great time in your Eastern Europe. So close to my heart.
And so, yes, I am going to ask, have you spent any time on the Oregon coast? I'm not sure exactly where in Oregon you are. Mm-hmm. Which is the best Oregon coastal town in your
opinion? Wow. There are so many nice ones. Yeah. We're about an hour and a half or 2 hours away from the Oregon coast, so we do have opportunity to visit frequently. Yeah. Cannon Beach is probably the number one as far as like if you're only visiting one place, the scenery is magnificent everywhere, but there is particularly good. I like Newport for families because there's like sea lions there and there's a really nice aquarium.
Love
So you
it.
can't go wrong,
I
honestly. But those
know.
are like the two hottest spots probably.
Okay, cool. Can't get out of, mentioning my toddlers, but they love sea lions and otters especially, which are
And tide pools, we've got starfish or sea stars, I'm sorry.
oh,
Sea
very
stars and all
cool.
these cool things. Yeah, let me know if you visit.
Oh, I certainly will. But yeah, we'll wrap things up. I won't take any more of your time. Thank you again, Patty, for being on the podcast, and thank everyone for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your month, and tune in with us next time.